Productions. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities." Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks merge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is March 28th, 2010, Sunday, and Bill Fink is with us for the next installment of Joseph Goebbels' Communism with the Mask Off. How are you doing tonight, sir? Bill? Can you hear me all right?
Hello, praise Yahweh, and to hell with all the fags and the obscene people.
Absolutely. Praise Yahweh.
And all the other sinners that we should not forgive.
We're not here to coddle them.
We should get ourselves from. Right. How you doing today?
If they want to repent and come back into the community, they're welcome to do so, but we're not here to pat them on the head and tell them that while they're living a sinful life, they're right with God.
No, there's no place for pornography and homosexuality in the kingdom of heaven. It's evil and it has to be put away. And we have to take a stand against it. That's what repentance is all about.
I wonder if
turning from our sin and turning others from it also.
Do these people think there'll be strip clubs in the kingdom of heaven?
I guess so, because it's a disease. It's riddled the entire all of Christendom. It is polluted with strip clubs and porno magazines and porno films, and it's destroyed generations of women, and it's perverted generations of men, and we have blatant open homosexuality, and we have to turn from it.
And it's the
Jewish agenda. It's the Jews that have done this to us. They are the purveyors of all pornography, and they are the purveyors of all and promoters of all sexual deviancy.
It goes right back to the garden, though, with Nakash. Wasn't the first great temptation was a sexual one?
Exactly. The fall of Adam was around sex and sexual promiscuity.
And they're repeating that. They've been repeating that for the last several thousand years. They're the great purveyors and basically promoters, panderers, aren't they?
There is no doubt. That's what they do. That's how they've earned their living and sucked the lifeblood of our race for 5,000 years.
All right, then. So, Goebbels, where did we leave off?
Goebbels, well, we left off on page 11, but we should probably wind it back just a little bit to the bottom of page 10, where he starts his unvarnished picture of the communist uprisings and the communist crimes committed throughout the West. At the beckoning of the Soviets in Russia.
All right. Would you like to begin, or shall I?
I will. Here I shall give an unvarnished picture, which is backed up in all particulars by incontestable facts. And just as an aside, I'm reading from Communism with the Mask Off, and it's available at mk.christagenia.org in several formats. If there is a spark of reason left in the world and the faculty for clear thinking, then the states and peoples must be shocked at the prospect and induced to come together for their common defense against this acute danger. I leave the methods and practices of the communist propaganda and theory within and without Russia to speak through examples, which appear to me to be symptomatic. These examples could be replaced and supplemented by thousands of others, all of which, when taken together, show up the terrible aspect of this world disease. Murder of individuals, murder of hostages, and mass murder are the favorite means by which Bolshevism to get rid of all opposition to its propaganda. And here we see that they begin to use violence to accomplish the same thing through thug groups such as the ARA. In Germany, 300 nationalist socialists fell victims to communist terror practiced on individuals. On the 14th January 1930, Horst Wessel was shot through the half-open door of his house by the communist Albrecht Hohler. called Ali, his accessories being the Jews, Sally Epstein and Elsie Kahn. On the 9th of August, 1931, the police captains, Anloff and Lenk, were shot down on the Bülow Platz in Berlin. The communist leaders, Heinz Neumann and Kippenberger, were accused as instigators of the murder. Shortly afterwards, Heinz Neumann was arrested in Switzerland because of a passport which was invalid, and a request for extradition made by Germany was not granted on the plea that it was a political crime. That's incredible, and that's what, aren't all crimes political? Or aren't all politicians criminals? These are only some single examples of the communist terror wreaked on individuals as further instances of the bloodlust and cruelty to which they bear evidence. We may turn to the hostage murders which took place in previous years. A political crime. That's incredible. It's still a crime, isn't it? On April 30th, 1919, in the courtyard of the Luitpold Gymnasium in Munich, 10 hostages, among them one woman, were shot through the backs, their bodies rendered unrecognizable and taken away. In Munich. Now, this is in Bavaria.
I wonder if Spielberg's ever going to make a film about this.
Never happen. It won't happen.
He made a Munich film about the Israeli athletes being killed by Palestinians at the 72 Summer Olympics, but how come no one's ever made a film about the murder of hostages in the Weimar era?
Well, maybe if they ever pass that Equal Time Act concerning the what do they call that? The Fair Use Act or something?
Something like that.
They insisted both sides of the, you know, the conservative view or both liberal and conservative views get equal time in the media. That'll never happen either. That they squawk about it as if that they're outnumbered when they actually control 99% of the media.
The fairness doctrine.
Yeah, the fairness doctrine. That's what I'm trying to come up
fairness
with.
Fairness from a Jew.
Right. This act was done at the order of the communist terrorist Egelhofer and under the responsibility of the Jewish Soviet commissaries Levine, Levine-Nissen, and Axelrod. There's a familiar name. In 1919, during the Bolshevik regime of the Jew, Bela Kun, whose real name was Aaron Kahn, in Budapest, 20 hostages were murdered. And I'm going to get into that in a little bit about Jewish political leaders as criminals. During the October Revolution in Spain, 8 prisoners were shot at Oviedo, 17 in Tehran, and in the barracks of Polano to protect the communist attack, 38 prisoners were placed at the head of the insurgents and some of them shot. Isn't that what the enemy always does? They play on our empathy for the unarmed civilian by putting them at the front of an insurgency?
Absolutely.
That they did it in Vietnam. They've done it all through time.
That's what terrorists do.
Take the innocent people and use them as a shield.
Well, Jews pioneered terrorism.
Yes, they did. That they're the authors of terrorism. At the Comintern Congress on July 31, 1935, the communist leader Carcio, this is in Spain, from Spain, expressly declared that this revolution was carried through under the leadership of the communists. This list of bloodshed becomes all the more fearful and horrible when we add to it the apparently incredible number of mass murders carried out by the communists. As a classical prototype of this, we have the Paris Commune of the year 1871, which was passionately celebrated by Karl Marx and is approved today by modern Soviets as the model of the Bolshevik World Revolution. The number of victims who fell in that terrible year 1871 can no longer be ascertained. The Jewish Czechist, Bela Kun, made an experiment which rivaled the Paris Commune in bloodshed when he ordered the execution of 60 to 70,000 people in the Crimea. For the most part, these executions were carried out with machine guns. At the municipal hospital in Lubka, 272 sick and wounded were brought out on stretchers in front of the gate of the institution and there shot. The truth of this has been officially confirmed in a report made to the Geneva Red Cross.
Well, it seems that the International Red Cross reported on the Bolshevik situation, but they never once condemned any of the concentration camps the Germans are running. All those camps were given clean bills of health. So
and they've actually apologized for that 50 years later, 60 years later.
So if there was a Holocaust going on, the International Red Cross must have missed it.
Yeah, I don't know how they missed 6 million. they found out about 272 people in the Crimea being shot outside a hospital, but they missed the murder of 6 million Jews. That's
and 10 million others. Don't forget them.
They just weren't watching very well, I guess. They must have been shorthanded during those years or something. During the 133 days of his terror rule in Hungary, the Jew, Bela Kun, had innumerable men murdered. The names of 570 of those have been given in official documents. In November 1934, the Chinese marshal, Chiang Kai-shek, made public the information that in the province of Kiangxi, 1 million people were murdered by the communists and 6 million robbed of all their possessions. All these blood-stained and horror-raising events have reached a climax in the mass murders committed throughout Soviet Russia. Now, I would think that the Americans must have known about the crimes of Russia if 1 million people were killed by, in China, were killed by communists. That, then the American government had to know that. They had to know what was going on in the Ukraine and in Russia proper, which is,
absolutely,
you know.
Absolutely. The Jews in charge of the American government knew what their Jewish cousins were doing in Eastern Europe and Asia.
And concealed it from the American people very successfully.
And Rosenfeld was a Jew.
Well, yes, he was a Jew at least through the Delano line, and that's been established. And it's very possible he was a Jew through the Roosevelt line also.
I call him Rosenfeld.
Well, if it doesn't work, it still fits. The names of 500, okay, I Chiang Kai-shek, Soviet Russia, 1 million people murdered in China. That's the...
Just in that era.
That's 1934.
Since we know when Mao came to power, he killed upwards of 50 to 100 million more with his Great Leap Forward.
Well, absolutely. And every Jewish Great Leap Forward is really, in reality, a Great Leap Backwards.
Or the nation is moving forward and we don't have room for you people who won't turn into degenerates, so we're going to have to kill you.
Right. According to returns given by the Soviets themselves and taking reliable sources into account, the number of persons executed within the first 5 years of Soviet rule must be placed at about 1,860,000 in round numbers. Of these, 6,000 were teachers and professors. 8,800 were doctors of medicine. 54,000 were army officers. 260,000 were soldiers. 105,000 were police officials. 49,000 were gendarmes, which is actually another type of a police official.
Yes.
12,800 were civil servants of other types, I guess. 355,000 were persons of the upper classes. 192,000 were workers. So much for the proletariat. And 815,000 were peasants, which might explain why they didn't have any food.
I guess they didn't like their own leaders, since the leaders were the leaders of the workers and the peasants, but the workers and peasants had to die since they didn't like their own leaders.
Right, that's absolutely incredible, isn't it? I guess the leaders weren't the workers after all. Huh?
And it seems that they went about obliterating the intelligentsia, wouldn't you say?
Well, yes, they did, and that's I'm going to get into that a little later, too, because this, you know, it's the intelligentsia that has been the largest promoter of communism in the West. The Soviet statistician Oganowski estimates the number of persons who died of hunger in the years 1921-1922 at 5.2 million. The Austrian Cardinal Archbishop, and we saw this when we read the introduction to this speech last week, we saw that the translator had given citations which corroborate this information. The Austrian Cardinal Archbishop, Monsignor Initzer, said in his appeal of July 1934 that millions of people were dying of hunger throughout the Soviet Union. During his speech delivered before the House of Lords on the 25th July 1934, the Archbishop of Canterbury, speaking of reports relative to the famine victims in Soviet Russia in 1933, said that the number was nearer to 6 million than the 3. Famine victims. I don't think they were really famine victims because the famine was engineered by the politicians.
It's not a famine if the NKVD takes away all the food you're growing.
Right.
It's basically a murder through hunger.
Absolutely. It's a starving to death.
And haven't the Bolsheviks and the Jews, they've always used hunger as a weapon.
Yes, and even if there was a famine in that year, which it's established that there was, if all of the food that you grew in 1931, 32, and 33, and all that grain has been stripped from you, Well, then you don't have anything to live through a famine with, do you?
No. And it seems the Jews are always against preparation, aren't they? They mock people that try and plan ahead for unforeseen times, and they want us to basically just live day to day.
Yes, they do. There is no doubt, because they want us to be dependent on them. Just and they have. Most of the West is dependent on them. The average grocery store, if it didn't get any deliveries, would be out of food in 3 days or less.
Absolutely. And then basically the cities would just be concrete jungles of misery and death. And I think that's what they're counting on.
Well, right. Roaming bands of savages is exactly what they'll degenerate to in about 4 days.
And anybody who wants to see what will ultimately come should listen to our shows on Russia number one, and it'll just be a repeat of that, except in America. Except here, we're not as thoroughly disarmed as the Russian peasants were.
And let me make an aside here, because I spent a lot of time in amongst the beasts in the beast system. And those people, Negroes and Hispanics, they don't save and ration anything. I've witnessed this firsthand. They don't. If they have 2 weeks' worth of food, what I would consider to be 2 weeks' worth of food, it would last me 2 weeks. It would last them 4 or 5 days. And then they would be scavenging for the next week and a half. I've seen that firsthand over and over again.
Well, they've done studies that have consistently shown the black race basically plans ahead in terms of minutes to hours, and they went into a classroom with kindergartners, white children and black children. They offered them either the opportunity for 1 ounce of chocolate right now, or you wait a week and you get a pound. Without exception, almost all of the white children elected to wait 1 week, and all of the black children demanded the 1 ounce immediately.
Well, right. I saw that very mentality firsthand. I watched it for, basically 25 years.
They don't plan for the future.
They need instant gratification. They want to consume immediately, and they worry about an hour from now when it gets here.
And they hate you because you save and plan ahead, and they think that since they've gotten all of their stuff now, that tomorrow, since they have nothing, since they used it all the day before, they're entitled to half of your stuff or all of your stuff.
Absolutely.
You know, how you got all that stuff still? I ain't got no stuff.
Exactly. And I've seen that firsthand, and I've seen that attitude firsthand. And I could probably tell several stories about it.
You know, because yesterday I ate half as much as they ate. They ate everything. And then the next day I still have half of my stuff left over. They expect that I need to fork over some of it.
Yep. And that's, you know, that's democracy. And the best description, the most succinct description of democracy I've seen was A. Ralph Epperson. I don't know if it was original with him. But he basically said that democracy is when three men are stranded on a desert island and they find six coconuts, and two of the men are very not very frugal, and they eat both their coconuts the first day, and the second day they vote to take the third guy's coconuts, and that's a democracy.
And then the man has to pull out his gun and contest it, and it becomes a republic.
Well, yeah, if he has a gun.
I think that that's the only reason the Jews haven't repeated the Bolshevik Revolution in this country. One, because as you've said, we capitulated in the 60s and 70s with the culture war. But also, the people here are so well armed, if there were Jews marching through the streets screaming peace, land, bread, and burning things down, a lot of Jews would get killed in the process of revolutionizing this society.
Well, yeah, you know, that's true. And they've really tried to break, they've done all they can to break the fiber of that society down through not only through the churches teaching basically communism and pacifism, and to love your enemies means also to love the enemies of God. I guess they perverted that, right?
Absolutely. They teach to, you know, love your enemies and let them dominate you.
Right. But they've tried like hell for 80 years now to disarm this country. And in a lot of states, they virtually succeeded.
Since they're having such a tough go of it, though, they've just vamped up the culture war to the point where it doesn't matter that people are so well armed. They're not using their guns as they should be using them.
Well, that's absolutely true.
You know, in a sane society, a population this well armed would have risen up decades ago.
Right, and especially after the passage of this Health Care Act.
And since they have the means to revolt, they just don't have the will or the inclination.
No, they have no will at all. They only have the will to watch the next football game.
It seems if the Russian peasants and workers had the kind of armaments we have, there wouldn't have been a Soviet Union.
No, there's no way there would have been a Soviet Union. Those people, if those 815,000 peasants had the guns that most Americans, you know, that many Americans have, there's no way there would have been a Soviet Union. That's absolutely true.
But they didn't have to worry about being brainwashed with TV. It seems the Jews have used TV in this country to full effect.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt. That's the real opiate of the masses. And I actually had that analogy drawn in a couple of pages. Okay. We have thus before our eyes a full picture of this fearful and harrowing mass terrorization, which is only approximately paralleled by even the most blood-curdling examples of war or revolution that are recorded in the history of the world. This is the actual system of bloodshed and terror and death, which is carried out by hysterical and criminal political maniacs who would have copied it in every country and among every people with the same terrorizing practices, insofar as they might find the possibility of doing so. And this is what Germany feared. And Germany was very close to this from 1919 to 1929,
well,
weren't they?
The Jews were trying to terrorize them into capitulating since they'd spent decades working the culture war and they weren't satisfied with the progress since they'd been checked by the Freikorps in 1919 with the Bavarian Socialist Republic that they attempted to bring up. So now they were just using hostage crisis after hostage crisis and basically street-level terror. Wouldn't you agree that they basically had the ARA thugs, what we would call ARA today, and they were out there terrorizing the German masses?
Yes, they were. And fortunately, they had the Free Corps, which was
and other groups.
Today's militias probably would never do it. They wouldn't do it. They wouldn't. If the Marxist thugs had done in this country what they did in Germany in 1919, I don't think today's militias would stand up.
Well, they're neutered because you can't take the law into your own hands. They don't want to be seen as intrusive or domineering or fascist. They don't.
Well, right, but where do you draw the line? When the government doesn't protect you, where do you draw the line?
Exactly.
Well, we're going to see that in this country, and we're probably going to see it soon.
They can either be labeled fascist or they can be labeled a corpse. It's their choice. Either they can fight the Bolsheviks or the Bolsheviks will kill them.
Well, right. Your life shouldn't matter when it's the life of your families at stake and the future of your children. Your life should not matter. And that's the attitude Adolf Hitler had. It shines through in Mein Kampf. That the nation is more important. And the nation was, of course, an ethnic nation to Adolf Hitler.
And if we all rally together and fight, they can't kill us all.
No. In view of all this, it would be idle to bring forward proofs of the spirit of discipline and generous consideration which the National Socialists showed in carrying through their revolutionary aims. Such is the strange and terrible resemblance, and he's referring back to the same newspaper he opened up the speech with, that there was a newspaper, at the beginning of the speech he described a newspaper report from England, and the reporter was actually saying that nationalism and Sovietism or Bolshevism were the same, were one and the same. They were very much alike in every way.
And I've seen this ridiculous charge made on websites from Stormfront to other sites, and I've had nationalists and activists tell me that they don't like National Socialism because it has the word socialism in there, and they think it's similar to communism, or that Hitler was a leftist, or Hitler was a closet Marxist, or Hitler was inspired by Marxism, or they'll dance around the issue. And one of them tried to debate me about the differences between fascist communism and socialist communism, and I said there's nothing fascist about communism and nothing communistic about fascism. Fascism and communism are anathema.
Well, they're idiots that haven't sat and thought it out, and they haven't read Mein Kampf.
And
how do you define Adolf Hitler unless you've read what Adolf Hitler wrote?
They haven't read Mein Kampf, but they've read Table Talk, so they think they know.
Right, and Table Talk is just it's just a device of the Jews to help further cloud the issue, because Table Talk is straight garbage.
It's a
straight fabrication.
These people think to learn about Hitler, they should consider every source except Hitler himself. Whereas if you want to learn about Hitler, why not start by reading the book that he himself wrote?
Well, that's where you should start.
That's a rather novel
idea.
With
any study is from the original source.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully from a decent version of it, because that Ralph Manheim version of it's no good.
Absolutely.
Revolutions cost money. Oh, I'm sorry. Such is the strange and terrible resemblance between the methods followed by the two regimes, nationalism, National Socialism, and Bolshevism, which the writer of the article in the English newspaper alleges to be similar in essential structure. But the facts to which I have referred do not fill out the picture. Revolutions cost money. Propaganda campaigns throughout the world must be financed. Bolshevism procures the means of doing so after its own fashion. He doesn't really go into... Oh, yes, he does go into details in one way. In the summer of 1907, Stalin led the notorious bomb attack at Tiflis on a money transport from the state bank. 30 persons fell victims to the attack. The 250,000 rubles, which were robbed from the transport, were sent to Lenin, who was then in Switzerland. They were to be at his disposal for revolutionary purposes. On the 17th of January 1908, the Jew Wallach Meir, who now goes by the name Litwinow and has been chairman of the Council of the League of Nations, was arrested in Paris in connection with the bombing and robbing of the transport at Tiflis.
So here we have a literal terrorist who later becomes the leader of an entire nation.
Well, you know something? That is a pattern with the Jew. Israeli prime ministers. Labor minister, David Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion and the Haganah became convinced that they would have to drive the British out if they were ever going to get their state. That required unity within the ranks of Zionism, and they proposed a joint military campaign to the Irgun and Stern gang, who, until the autumn of 1945, they had solemnly proclaimed to be terrorists, fascists, and madmen. So now Ben-Gurion is making a pact with this gang, right? And Begin, Menachem Begin, who during the Saison had put up wall posters comparing them to Quisling and Laval, eagerly accepted. Begin had considered Ben-Gurion an equivalent of Quisling, who was a so-called Swedish traitor, or Norwegian traitor, I forget.
Quisling was in Norway.
Okay, Norwegian traitor. So Ben-Gurion was the head of the Jewish agency. After the adoption of the United Front against the British, Ben-Gurion directed the terrorist war from the shadows. At this time, it was he who gave the green light for nearly all Jewish terrorist activity against the British. The British possessed Palestine. They took it from the Turks. It was their territory. That British blood fell on the battlefield for the conquest of the Ottoman Empire. The public relations disaster caused by the King David Hotel bombing brought with the detente with the Irgun and Stern gang to an end. The Jewish agency denounced the attack, claiming that the Irgun had violated its specifications as to when the bomb should be set. Yeah, right. In other words, it's okay to bomb, but we didn't tell them to bomb it when there were people in it, I guess.
He claims that they issued a warning.
After directing the 1948 war to conquer Palestine and drive out its inhabitants, he became prime minister. So we have a terrorist is elevated to be the first Israeli prime minister. The Labor Prime Minister M. Charette, qualifications, close associate of the war criminals and terrorists mentioned above, believed in the aims of the war criminals, however, differed on the means of establishing those aims. For example, he tried to prevent the Kibya attack ordered by David Ben-Gurion and carried out by Ariel Sharon, another familiar name. Fearing that such ruthless attacks, in this case a massacre, might alienate Western opinion. In other words, he wasn't opposed to the attacks for reason of morals. He was opposed to them because he didn't want to alienate the West.
Isn't that what Hitler said, that the Zionists who were opposed by members of their own race were not disowned as fellow Jews and kicked out? They were simply cautioned that they would bring heat down on the Jewish race as a whole, and they were told to keep their Zionist ambitions quiet.
Right. That's
They're never told don't do that, it's wrong. They're told don't do that, we'll look bad.
Exactly. Labor Prime Minister Eshkol, qualification, although not personally a terrorist, assassin, or war criminal, Eshkol organized the 1967 war, which resulted in the largest expansion of the Jewish state ever. Well, that was a war crime, too. Labor Prime Minister Golda Meir, singularly unsuited for the job of Prime Minister of Israel, before becoming Prime Minister, was neither a known terrorist nor war criminal. However, in February 1973, as Prime Minister, Golda Meir authorized the shooting down of a Libyan civilian airliner over to Sinai by Israeli jet fighters, killing all 107 passengers and its French crew. So it seems she was more suited to the job than was initially apparent. Yitzhak Rabin, war criminal, in 1948, on instruction from David Ben-Gurion, ethnically cleansed some 70,000 Palestinians from Lydda and Ramla. This included the massacre of several hundred resident civilians to get them moving. In 1967, Rabin ordered the ethnic cleansing of some 5,000 from the villages of Emwas, Beit Nuba, and Yalu, and the dynamiting and bulldozing of their homes. Menachem Begin, killer, terrorist, war criminal, leader of the terrorist gang Irgun, responsible for the Deir Yassin massacre and the bombing of the King David Hotel. Shamir, qualifications, killer, terrorist, war criminal, operations commander of the terrorist Stern gang. Together with Stern, proposed a wartime alliance with Adolf Hitler and the establishment of a totalitarian Jewish state. Responsible, with Begin, for the Deir Yassin massacre, the organizer of two infamous assassinations, the killing of Lord Moyne, the British minister resident for the Middle East, on 6th of November 1944, and the slaying of Count Folke Bernadotte, the UN's special mediator on Palestine, 17th September 1948. So we see that, and there's more than this, and I'm not going to beat it to death, but Perez, Shimon Peres, Benjamin Netanyahu, Ariel Sharon, they all got their start in political life as terrorists and war criminals.
I'm looking at a list. It's even Wikipedia admits it. A list of Irgun attacks, 1937 to 1948. The list just goes on, day after day, month after month. Bombings. 43 Arabs killed at a bombing in a marketplace in Haifa. 33 Arabs killed. British soldiers killed. Foreign tour, blah, 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 you know, journalists killed, police officers assassinated, government official assassinated, kidnapped British NCOs hanged, policemen killed in bank robbery, and this just goes on and on, bombing after bombing after bombing.
And when you look at the names of everybody involved, what you'll see is an entire roster of the future politicians of the legitimized state in Palestine.
They came to power through terror.
Yes, they came to power through terror, and then they were all the key players later on.
And now they condemn the Palestinians for using the tactics they themselves initiated. So
well, there's no doubt.
If the Palestinians are using terror, it's only because they learned it from the Israelis.
And here we see that Stalin got his start as a criminal, robbing trains. He went from train robber to the supreme Soviet leader of the country.
But I guess if I want to be president of the United States, I should start knocking off liquor stores.
It seems that that's if you were a Jew, that would work. Okay. The Communist Party in Germany organized and led the plunder expeditions there, and also the robbery of explosives from official depots. The list of such cases brought before the courts of the Reich is very long. In this list are 30 crimes described as major and extreme cases. To them must be added the burnings and bombings organized and perpetrated without any consideration whatsoever for the lives of innocent persons.
But, you know, whenever dynamite goes missing from a quarry site here, they immediately do a raid against some Christian militia.
Right. Right, that's what they do. And it's probably some Jewish bank robber.
Some ARA guy who's going to go blow up an SUV.
Yeah. On the 16th of April, 1925, there was an explosion in the Cathedral of Sofia, which had been organized and carried out by the Bolsheviks. In July 1927, the communists set the Palais de Justice at Vienna on fire. To celebrate the Lenin feast on the 22nd of January 1930, the Simonov Monastery at Moscow, a building dating from the 14th century, was blown up. On the night of the 27th to 28th February 1933, the Reichstag in Berlin was set on fire as a signal for the armed communist rising through the medium of strike, and they blame that on Hitler today.
Interestingly enough, they caught a Dutch communist who had a history of convictions for arson at the scene. That was just a coincidence, though, wasn't it?
Well, absolutely, I'm sure. He must have just been walking his dog or something. Through the medium of strikes, street fights, and armed risings, the first preparatory stage of the Bolshevik Revolution is meant to be effected. The methods used are the same in all countries. A long series of revolutionary acts, which might be added on all sides, furnish a striking witness of this. In one of its propagandist publications, the Comintern boasted that it had organized nearly all the strikes which have taken place during recent years. These strikes find their violent sequel in street fights. From the street fight to the armed rising is but one step. In this sequence, the following risings took place. October 1917 in Russia, January 1919, the Spartacus Rising in Germany, 1920, the Max Holz Revolt in Vogtland, and the Red Army in the Ruhr District, that's not in Russia, that's in Germany, 1921 in Central Germany. September 1923 at Hamburg, December 1924 at Reval, on the October 23rd, 1926, 22nd February 1927, and 21st March 1927 in Shanghai, December 1927 in Canton, this is China, October 1934 in Spain, April 1935 in Cuba, and May 1935 in the Philippines, which were both actually United States territories at that time.
Yes.
Cuba was not granted independence until 1945. Bolshevik propaganda aims its chief blows against the armed forces of a country because the Bolsheviks know that if they were to adopt the principle of trying to secure support from the majority of the people, they could never carry out their plans. Force, therefore, is the only means left to them. But in every well-ordered state, this merits with the opposition of the army. The Bolsheviks, accordingly, feel bound to introduce their disintegrating propaganda within the ranks of the army itself. And that's one thing this country has been blessed with, is that we've always had a pretty patriotic armed services, which is very conservative and very anti-communist.
That's why they're trying to make it multicultural and full of fags and feminists.
Well, right. My next statement was that the Jews have been punishing it since the Vietnam War for that reason. That they've been punishing and degrading our military since the Vietnam War for that
call
very
them
reason.
Baby killers and whatnot.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all those boys came home from Vietnam, came home to abuse and disdain.
And now they're claiming it's a myth that no soldier was ever spat upon.
Yeah, right. Well, I remember the propaganda. The Bolsheviks accordingly feel bound to introduce their disintegrating propaganda within the ranks of the army itself. Their idea is to corrupt it from within and thus render it ineffective as a bulwark against anarchy. Well, that's what they're doing to our armed services right now.
That's what they've done to the police.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
The ADL trains
the police. I know that firsthand, too. And now they're doing it to the armed forces. Before the advent of National Socialism to power in Germany, there was the closest cooperation between the Soviet espionage and the communist organizations here. A foreign department of the OGPU operated officially in our country. It was the special representative and directive agent of the communist espionage. The aim, so the OGPU is operating in Germany at the expense of the 800,000 dead peasants. The aim of this espionage was not only to obtain military secrets in a traitorous way, but also to carry on a system of sabotage among the police and the army. Part of the program was to introduce a mutinous spirit into the Reichswehr, and by an increasing work of revolutionary instruction, to bring about a revolt of the soldiers and sailors in the German defense forces. From July 1931 to December 1932, 111 cases of high treason were dealt with before the German courts. These cases originated with the activities of the Communist Party. Furthermore, there was an extraordinary number of cases of espionage of a treasonable character in the industrial factories. The most boorish example of the interference of Soviet diplomats for the purpose of creating domestic political trouble in another country is afforded by the Jewish Soviet ambassador, Jaffa, who had to leave Berlin on the 6th of November, 1918. Now that's pretty soon. That's only a year after the October Revolution, basically. Because he had utilized the diplomatic courier to transport sabotage material, which was to be used to undermine the German army and make the revolution public. Possible, I'm sorry. What were called revolution funds were used in great part by Liebknecht for the purchase of weapons for the German communists and partly for the production of propaganda material to be used among the army. On the 26th of December, 1918, one of the socialist members of the Reichstag, the Jew, Dr. Oscar Cohn, declared that on the 5th of the previous month, he had received 4 million rubles from Jaffa, the Russian ambassador, for the purpose of the German Revolution. We can now see that all these activities were meant for the purpose of bringing about the downfall of the German Reich through the undermining and corruption of the German army. Amid all these single acts of terror, of hostage murders and mass murders, plunder and arson, strikes and armed risings, espionage and sabotage of armies, we see the communist world propaganda showing its forbidding and grimacing countenance. An idea and a movement which has used such dastardly and revolting means to secure power and to hold it can maintain itself only by chicanery, slander, and falsehood.
And that's why for years nothing got out of the East Bloc that they didn't want to get out. The only reporters they let in were ones that they approved, like that Look magazine I have from the 50th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. And these Jewish reporters went over there, came back and reported that people in the Soviet Union were living in a land of peace and plenty, and they were happier than Americans.
And our so-called intelligentsia, along with many other Jewish rumors, they bought all that right up. They actually believed all that. These are the typical methods used by Bolshevism in its propaganda, and they are applied in different ways according to the suitability of the occasion. Thus, for example, we can understand how it is that crises, catastrophes, etc., which happen in other countries outside the Soviet Union, are exploited by the Bolshevik propaganda. Whereas we are told that within the Soviet frontiers, a work of social construction is in progress that has banished economic distress and created a state in which there is no unemployment. The real truth is that a condition of commercial disorder exists throughout the country and an industrial collapse which baffles description. The land without unemployment contains hundreds of thousands and even millions of beggars and homeless children who throng the streets of the big cities, and hundreds of thousands who are condemned to banishment and forced labor. While in all the other countries alleged capitalist and fascist dictatorships are in power, Russia affords an example of freedom and democratic order, so we are told. In reality, this land is wilting under the Jewish Marxist rule of force, and we saw that very clearly from the British side, from the Russia No. 1 report, which will stop at no means to maintain itself in power. The pretended freedom and right of self-determination among the nationalities constituting the Soviet Union turns out, in fact, to be a process of enslavement and extirpation of those nationalities themselves. The pretended liberation of colonial and semi-colonial peoples throughout the international proletariat is, when looked at in its true light, a blood-stained and ruthless example of Soviet imperialism of the worst kind. In Germany itself, before our advent to power, our being the National Socialists, the pronouncements of the Communist Party varied unscrupulously according to the condition of the times. At first, Germany was a semi-colonial sacrifice to the Versailles powers and was held down through the League of Nations. But when the National Socialist movement began to make headway among the German public, the Communist Party put forward a program of social and national liberation. Then they proclaimed a proletariat confederacy between Berlin and Moscow and against Versailles and the League of Nations. Today, a military pact has been made with Paris and Prague, and the Soviets have entered the hitherto defamed League of Nations, which used to be known as the Robber League. The so-called peace policy of the Soviet Union practically shows itself in world revolutionary intrigues among the other countries, in unscrupulous stirring up of conflicts between the various states, while at the same time it is arming at a fantastic rate in preparation for a war of aggression. People in and this shows the efficacy of the Operation Barbarossa being a German offensive in the name of defense. That they knew that the Russians were coming, basically.
They had to preempt the Bolshevik attack.
Right, that's exactly what they had to do. Germany had to turn on Russia to preempt the Bolshevik attack and to save Western Europe from Bolshevism, which is exactly what they did. Threw herself on the pyre. People in Western European countries talk of a social order without class distinction, but in Russia itself, there is a violent differentiation between the privileged and dispossessed castes. The Soviet propaganda speaks of a paradise of children that contains the happiest youth in the world. Probably they figure they're all being molested by the Jews, so they should be happy, right? The real state of the case, however, shows us millions of unsupported children, the existence of child labor, and even the death penalty for children. Bolshevik propaganda deceitfully talks of the emancipation of woman through communism. The truth is that the institution of marriage has been completely set aside, that there is a terrible disintegration and abolition of family life, that there is an absence of employment for women, and a state of prostitution that is alarmingly on the increase. Such a regime, in which theory and practice are in glaring contradiction, cannot possibly maintain its position except by the propagation of falsehood and unscrupulous hypocrisy. Before the 30th of January, 1933, each time that a workman was murdered by the order of the communists, the crime was imputed to the National Socialists. There were constant false reports of mutinies among the stormtroops, and honest German workmen were branded as strikebreakers. When Horst Wessel was assassinated, the public horror became so great that the communists had to bow before it, and to clear themselves, this sounds like the American media today, they put forward the story that this dastardly political misdeed arose from an altercation between rival claimants to a mistress. When Norkus, who was a member of the Hitler Youth, was stabbed by some communist brutes, the Rotfahn barefacedly declared that Norkus was killed by a Nazi spy, so that the Nazis were alleged to have murdered a 17-year-old member of their own party in order to procure material to have the German Communist Party forbidden by law.
Sounds like something the Mossad would do.
Absolutely. The same happened when Mikowski and Gotsky were assassinated. You want to pick
right.
up?
Sure. When National Socialism showed up the work of the Communist Party in Germany, the Communist International started the propagandist atrocity stories against National Socialism. The London mock trial was meant to acquit the Communist Party of any guilt connected with the Reichstag fire. The burning of the Reichstag was barefacedly and brazenly stated to be a provocative act on the part of National Socialism, conceived by myself and put into effect by my party comrade, General Goering. After the death of the German National Party member of the Reichstag, Herr Oberfohren, the communists who had fled from Germany to Paris forged what pretended to be a memorandum by Oberfohren, in which proof was supposed to be given that the burning of the Reichstag had been supported and approved by leading National Socialists. The dead member of the Reichstag could not deny what had been falsely attributed to him. Later on, however, avowals were made by people who had formerly been communist leaders that not a single word of the truth was contained in the memorandum. Don't the Jews always do this? They wait until after somebody dies and they defame him horribly.
All the time.
You know, Thomas Jefferson has a mulatto child. There's no proof of that. Strom Thurmond did this, Strom Thurmond did that. They always wait until just after someone dies, and then they bring it out. They can never bring it up while someone's alive and let them answer the accusations.
And today they do that to tear down the pillars of Western civilization, that they take all of our icons and defame them so that it cheapens our civilization.
Alexander the Great was a fag, blah, blah, blah. So-and-so was a fag. The Greeks were all fags. The Romans were all fags.
And Jesus was a Jew. And they're all lies.
Or Hitler was a fag who had one testicle. They seem to always fixate on sexual things.
Oh, absolutely. That is look at the Jewish comedians.
That's where their mind is.
They have no jokes without sex. Look at Lenny Bruce. he was one of the first big icebreakers. And he was a total pervert. He was an absolutely degenerate man.
Jewish humor is basically just bathroom humor.
Look at that Adam Dice Clay. I mean, the only names I know are pretty old because I don't watch anything anymore. But
I've never heard of these people because Jewish comedy, it's not funny. It's perverse.
Well, Lenny Bruce was a big stand-up comedian in the 50s and 60s that killed himself with narcotics. And he was a fag. And every joke and everything, every skit was challenged the ethics of the time. And broke down the ethics of the time. That's what Jews do. They're perverts. They're disgusting. And Adam Dice Clay is a clown from the 80s that basically tried to do the same thing. But he's an example, but there have been millions of them.
The whole thing was avowed by them to have been falsified in all its details for the purpose of bringing National Socialism into discredit before the world. Jurists and journalists of repute, and even an English lord, descended to the level of making marionettes of themselves at this London mock trial. Since that time, the communists have been carrying on a worldwide systematic work of propaganda against Germany because they recognize and realize that the National Socialists are their most dangerous enemies. Among the eternally recurring themes of this communist agitation are the stories of war preparations in the interests of German imperialism, preparations for a revanche against France, annexations in Denmark and Holland and Switzerland, in the Baltic states, in the Ukraine, etc., and a German crusade against the Soviet Union. Dissensions in the party and government, especially between the party and the army, growing discontent among the masses, assassinations of leading men in Germany or attempts on their lives, preparations for an inflation and the coming of a complete economic collapse, the murder and torturing of prisoners, religious persecutions, and cultural vandalisms of all kinds. None of that ever happened. There was no economic collapse in Germany. There was an economic boom. There was no cultural vandalism. It was a cultural revival. But since they took Jewish filth out of the art museums, I guess the Jews consider that an offense against culture.
And they would do the same thing today. I mean, they defend their filth in the same way today.
But I mean, if I came to power, you came to power, anybody reasonable came to power, you could just go into a museum and remove 98% of what's in there because it's all Jew filth and garbage.
Right, we may as well gut the whole museum and have it renovated and have the Jewish icons renovated gutted along with it.
They would cry, though, and say that their masterpieces had been denigrated.
Right, like the Piss Christ, like the crucifix and the vat of urine that they screamed about freedom of expression.
And they financed it with public money.
But if you burn a cross, that sends you to federal prison for 5 years.
That's a hate crime.
That's not freedom of expression. That's a hate crime.
And that one guy, I think he's a Cuban Jew. His latest artwork involves fecal matter. He has to be a Jew, wouldn't you say?
Oh, definitely. No, there's no doubt. That's what they specialize in. Everything filthy.
These propagandist falsehoods are sent out through the thousands of channels and in thousands of ways. Bourgeois intellectualism, sometimes unconsciously, sometimes consciously, is pressed into the service of this campaign of defamation. In all European capitals, there are large offices for the spread of this poison throughout the world, and large subsidies are furnished by the Comintern to prepare and carry out the work. These organizations are constant centers of unrest among the nations. They never tire of stirring up trouble every way they possibly can. That is Bolshevist propaganda. That is the form in which it clothes itself and lives, using falsehood and slander and chicanery, so as to make the nations suspicious of one another and to hate one another, thus spreading a general spirit of unrest. Because the Bolsheviks know so well that they can never bring the communist idea to triumph except in an age that is distracted and skeptical. And the Jews have been promoting skepticism for centuries, haven't they?
Well, yes, they have, and they've done it. That's the that was the central modus operandi of the the Frankfurt School.
And the
skeptical criticism.
And I think the so-called Enlightenment was basically skepticism too, in a sense, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And the Enlightenment is, yeah, you know, most of the great thinkers of the Enlightenment, most of them were Jews, or they were influenced heavily by Jewish thinkers.
Absolutely, I think definitely in France they were all influenced by Jews. I would say Rousseau. I would like to study that more thoroughly, but I would probably say my money would be on Rousseau being a Jew. I don't know about all the others, though, but we should get into that at some point in time.
We should, but I would have to dig a little deeper, and I don't know if there's good source material available.
We'll have to talk with Gerald.
Right.
All right, continuing on. In Germany, we have religious controversies which arise from profound questions of conscience, but have nothing whatsoever to do with a denial of religion. These controversies are exploited sometimes by harmless and sometimes malicious critics, and a parallel is drawn between them and the absolutely dogmatic atheism of the Bolshevik International. To realize the grotesqueness of the parallel, it is only necessary to point to a few examples in the theory and practice of communism. Within Christianity, you know, we have a lot of debate about issues, but the Bolsheviks, they have no room for debate. They simply say God doesn't exist, and if you believe otherwise, get ready for a bullet in the back of your head.
Absolutely.
In the program of the Communist International, it is openly and freely declared that the struggle against every kind of religion must be carried on ruthlessly and systematically. Lenin declared that, quote, religion is the opium of the people, and it is a species of fusel oil, end quote. These statements are published in the fourth volume of his works. At the Second Congress of Atheists, Bucharin declared that religion must be, quote, destroyed with the bayonet, end quote. The Jew, Guberman, who under the name of Jarolowsky is the leader of the Association of Militant Atheists in the Soviet Union, has made the following declaration. It is our duty to destroy every religious world concept. If the destruction of 10 million human beings, as happened in the last war, should be necessary for the triumph of one definite class, then that must be done, and it will be done. Now, can anyone ever show me a speech where Hitler said, I'm going to gas 6 million Jews?
Never.
But here we have the Jewish leaders of the Soviet Union saying, we're going to go out and kill tens of millions of people.
And they did it.
And
there's plenty of evidence that they did it.
And we'll never see a movie about it coming out of Hollywood. We'll probably never see a movie coming out, you know, about it anywhere outside of Western or Southern Europe, or maybe an Arab country. And we'll never read about it in the history books. And in fact, we had an entire unit on Holocaust literature in English class. I don't know what the Holocaust has to do with American literature, but we had a unit on it. Yet we never talked about Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Gulag Archipelago, the Soviet Union, the Cheka, the NKVD, the purges, Stalin's great, you know, show trials. That had, I think, a one-paragraph mention in our history book that Stalin was an oppressive dictator. He made an alliance with Hitler to temporarily carve up Poland. Hitler betrayed the alliance, attacked the Soviet Union, Cold War, blah, 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 Stalin dies. That was it. You know, the 20 million dead, 60 million dead, however many it was, they're not mentioned. They're just a footnote.
Yeah, you know, usually museums celebrate an art form or present the icons of a scientific discipline, or they commemorate an event at the scene of the event. And the Holocaust didn't happen all over the world, but there are Holocaust museums all over the country.
That's a good point. And what does the Holocaust have to do with America? You know, assuming it did happen, there should be Holocaust museums in Poland. Why are there Holocaust museums in Michigan?
If I want to go to a Civil War museum, where are you going to go? You're going to go to Virginia.
You're not going to go to Portugal, are you?
Maybe. You're not going to go to Portugal or Ireland. No, absolutely not. I'm not going to go to China to see a museum commemorating the burning of Atlanta.
You know, I saw a museum commemorating the Battle of Vicksburg, but it was in Vicksburg, Mississippi.
Well, that's probably a good place to find it. But
instead of Tijuana, Mexico.
I don't know why people don't see the problem with that. I have a problem with that.
Well, they say that we must remember, we must not forget, lest it repeats itself. Never again, never again. So they're talking about not forgetting something that never happened, yet they don't even know about something that did happen on a scale ten times as worse.
Which was a crime 10 times greater, exactly. Because they're
don't even know about
perpetrators of that crime. And in their purview, that wasn't a crime. That was a noble act, advancing them as Messiah.
And they want to repeat it.
Oh, yes, they want to repeat it. They want to repeat it here and in Western Europe and everywhere they can.
If the Jews could, they'd kill every white man, woman, and child in the world today.
That's the deeds of Satan. That's what Satan wants. That's the end game. That's what all this is about.
And it goes back to the serpent seed versus the seed of the woman.
Well, the only thing that explains history is two seed line Christian identity explains history perfectly. It's the perfect union of all history and Christianity. It's the only thing that has Christianity make any sense at all, and the Bible story make any sense at all.
The only thing that gives somebody a total, all-encompassing, complete worldview.
Right. It's the only thing that does.
All right. In its issues of 6th November 1930, The Atheist, the monthly periodical which is the central organ of the Association of Militant Atheists, wrote the following, quote, "We shall burn down all the churches of the world and raise all the prisons to the ground," quote. And they've pretty much done that in all the Western countries. They've turned the churches into basically brothels, for lack of a better term, where there's basically spiritual whoredom. And they've created a revolving door prison system, but the Soviet Union was one big prison camp.
And you know, the Bolsheviks and communism, and that they're absolutely atheists. They show it every time they come to power or any time they achieve any political power at all, that the atheism in them rises directly to the top, comes right to the forefront. But communism has been spread by the churches here in the Americas. And early on, it was especially prevalent in South America, the spread of communism. Through
liberation theology.
Well, liberation theology, but even in the Catholic Church. And I have in front of me and this will expose more than just the Catholic Church, but I have in front of me an article from USASurvival.org, the Catholic Church funding of ACORN. Federal funding of ACORN is not just a Democratic Party or Obama administration problem. As a chart produced by House Republican leader John Boehner shows, and they have a copy of the chart at this website, I'm at usasurvival.org/ck092209.html. Most of the federal money going to the organization was provided under President George W. Bush. This is not something that most Republicans want to talk about, especially now that they can use ACORN funding as a weapon against Obama and the Democrats. To Boehner's credit, however, he had sent a letter to Bush asking him to block all federal funding of ACORN. The Bush administration did not comply. That shows you whose side they're on, right? While Obama has strong ties to ACORN, they were originally established through the U.S. Catholic Church, which has also funded ACORN and similar organizations to the tune of millions of dollars. This is another taboo topic for most of the media. Even conservative news organizations are afraid of raising the issue, apparently fearing being tagged with the anti-Catholic label.
Well, I am anti-Catholic, so I'm not afraid of being called anti-Catholic.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, Catholicism is not Christianity. Catholicism is exactly what the founding fathers of this nation called it: popism or papalism or worship of the Pope. What it is.
In all educational establishments throughout the Soviet Union, religious instruction is forbidden, and in its place there has been introduced a systematic instructional course in Marxist atheism. And interestingly enough, while they did destroy the churches, they left the synagogues unmolested.
Yes, they did.
That's a rather cute coincidence, I suppose.
From a bunch of atheists. That must mean that the synagogues are atheist institutions.
Well, Wikipedia lists some of the Soviet leaders as Jewish converts to atheism. How do you convert to atheism?
It must be a religion.
Isn't that basically the religion of the Jew, the denial of God?
Yes, it is. That's basically what it boils down to.
Atheism always comes from Judaism.
Yes, it does.
Children under the age of 18 are forbidden to take part in religious services and prayers. Yet in this country, the ACLU would have us believe that children under 18 are fit to decide their own religion or decide no religion. So if a 13-year-old decides, no, I'm not going to go to the Baptist church with my parents, I'm an atheist, the ACLU will defend that right.
Yes, they will. And it might sound cool to the average teenager to be an atheist. They can't make rational decisions for their own. But
well,
the ACLU would insist that they do. I mean, in a world where a 13-year-old can divorce his parents, it's a sick world. And it's a Jewish world. All righteousness is turned upside down.
And I think you and Eli covered that in Isaiah 3:12, that women are the oppressors and children rule over them.
Yes, and that's the state we're in. And it's the burden of sin is on the men in this country.
Mm.
It's not the women's fault. It's not the children's fault. The men have abdicated their positions in their community.
There's a power vacuum.
And the government has become their god. So, yes, there's a power vacuum.
The church law of the 8th April, 1929 has established a situation in which spiritual and religious communities are deprived of all rights. All the clergy and their families belong to the dispossessed class of Soviet citizens, thus automatically losing their right to work or earn their livelihood, and they are liable to be removed from their domicile at any time whatsoever. So much for no unemployment if you're on a no-work list.
Well, you're not employable, so I guess you're technically not unemployed.
I wonder if there's such a list in this country. I have heard that they maintain a no-work list, and they circulate it, and they say, don't hire any of the people on this list.
Well, Rahm Emanuel basically announced at the beginning of, as soon as the Obama administration took power, that white men need not apply for jobs in this country.
Such is the theory and world concept of the juridical principles underlying Bolshevik atheism, and such principles are accordingly carried out in practice. Up to 1930, 31 bishops, 1,600 clergy, and 7,000 monks were murdered under the Soviet regime. According to statistics available for 1930, there were then confirmed in prisons under starvation conditions 48 bishops, 3,700 clergy, and 8,000 monks and nuns. The International League Against the Third International at Geneva issued statistics on August 6, 1935, showing that in Russia, 40,000 priests have been arrested, banished, or murdered. And not a word of this in America.
None whatsoever.
You wouldn't read about it in the New York Times, that's for sure.
And that's the irony, that the Catholic Church has spread communism in America. And you know, the liberation theology and a lot of the Protestant sects have done the same thing.
Nearly all the Orthodox churches and chapels have been either destroyed or else closed to religious worship and converted into clubs, cinemas, barns, etc. And I've read some places that claim that the SS, as they advanced across Russia, burned all the churches to the ground, but I'm wondering what churches. The Bolsheviks would have destroyed them decades ago.
Yeah, right. They already destroyed them. They blame the Germans for all their crimes. And they've actually, you know, it is genius. The Bolshevik genius is that they've actually gotten the institutions that are the primary targets once they take over to do their work for them, academia and organized religion.
They've gotten the institutions to gut themselves.
Yeah, well, they've gotten the institutions to promote their cause. And they were the first people they wiped out when they took power in Russia.
You know, thank you for doing our job for us. Boom, there's your bullet.
Right, thank you. Now you die.
That's the great tragedy. Those people don't see that they're going to be the first ones up against the wall.
It's incredible.
But they get to enjoy the revolution that they brought on for their countrymen. And it's fitting that they're the first victims in that sense then, isn't it?
Well, yes, they would deserve it first, that's for sure.
And I remember watching a documentary. They claimed that German soldiers advanced into a town in Belgium along a river, shot 400 people in the center of the town, bayoneted all the priests and nuns, burned the church to the ground, and threw all the bodies in the river in World War I. And I said to my dad as we're watching it that I'd like to see names of the soldiers involved. I'd like to see specifics of that, but all they did was it was a vague general description of an atrocity that I imagine never happened. Although maybe it happened in 1919, but it would have happened with the Bolsheviks, and it would have been somewhere in the Ukraine.
Well, there's no doubt.
That the Jews attribute their crimes to all other peoples, don't they?
Absolutely no doubt, and especially to Germans.
Prior to our advent to power, the atheist propaganda carried out by the Marxists in Germany, whose forces we have overthrown, took its stand in favor of the dreadful state of things which I have described. The Social Democratic League of German Free Thinkers alone had a membership of 600,000. The Communist League of Proletarian Free Thinkers had close to 160,000 members. I'm sure there wasn't a free thinker in the bunch. You raise the question of, hey, does God maybe exist? And bang, you get a bullet.
Right, there's no free thinkers in the bunch. They're a bunch of Marxist drones. They're whores for the Jews if they're not Jews.
They're slaves who think themselves free. They're fools who pronounce themselves wise. They're wise in their own eyes.
Well, right. Orwell basically portrayed Talmudism, I think.
Almost without exception, the intellectual leaders of Marxist atheism in Germany were Jews. That's a shock. Among them being Erich Weinhardt, Felix Abraham, Dr. Levi Lenz, and others. At regular meetings held in the presence of a notary public, members were requested to register their declaration of withdrawal from their church for a fee of 2 marks, and thus the fight for atheism was carried on. Between 1918 and 1933, the withdrawals from German evangelical churches alone amounted to 2.5 million persons in Germany. The program which these atheistic societies laid down in regards to sexual matters is amply characterized in the following demands, publicly expressed at meetings and distributed in leaflet form. 1. The complete abrogation of those paragraphs of the law dealing with the crime of abortion and the rights to have abortion procured free of charge in state hospital.
So we know that in I think it was 1972 or 1973 with Roe versus Wade, the communists already won in this country. The revolution of the 60s was a communist Jewish revolution, and they won with Roe versus Wade, basically.
And they'd done it to Germany 4 decades earlier.
Yes, they did.
2. Non-interference with prostitution. 3. The abrogation of all bourgeois capitalistic regulations in regard to marriage and divorce. 4. Official registration to be optional and the children to be educated by the community.
And they've done that here, too. In the 50s,
how can that be 60s? Optional if it's official registration? And they're basically saying, like, you know, mandatory optional registration.
Well, right, exactly.
They're talking out of both sides of their mouth.
At one time in most American states, and I don't really know the history of it that well, but I know that not long ago in most American states, divorce was not, you could not get divorced. There was no divorce.
Or you had to show serious grounds as an abandonment.
Well, right. This no-fault divorce, it's turned marriage into a trip to a fast food restaurant.
I was about to call it fast food divorce.
Yeah, that's what it is. And I'm a victim of that mentality myself. I mean, I was divorced too, but just because I partook in the sins don't mean that I agree with them now. I recognize it. And that's the mature way to be in your life. We can all sin, and we've all sinned in the past, but we have to be able to see it at some point.
5. Abrogation of all penalties for sexual perversities and amnesty to be granted to all persons condemned as sexual criminals. Translation, the legalization of bestiality, rape, pedophilia, molestation, homosexuality, anything.
And we see that, and it's a backdoor trip through these hate crime laws.
And, you know, I remember reading, I don't remember the actual instances because I wasn't around then, when they started to come out in favor of mixed-race marriages in the 60s, they said that we're never going to legalize homosexuality. First they said about segregation, you know, we're just going to give the black man the right to vote, we'll never end segregation. Then it's okay, we're going to end segregation, but we'll never have mixed-race marriages. Okay, we'll have mixed-race marriages, but we're never going to go after, you know, the gays are still gay, we're not going to let them out. Then the gays come along, they get their so-called rights to bugger each other. And then they say, okay, well, we're going to legalize homosexuality, but we'll never lower the consent age. We'll never legalize man-boy love. And that's the next thing the Jews start screaming for.
Well, isn't it Jews that founded NAMBLA? North
exactly.
America,
they never stop. They just push for more and more.
Yes, they do. And we don't see it. If you're found with the NAMBLA card in your wallet, it should be automatic extermination.
Exactly. There's no compromise with Satan. You can't bargain away morality. Truly a case of methodical insanity, which has for its aim the willful destruction of the nations and their civilization and the substitution of barbarism as a fundamental principle of public life. Where are the men behind the scenes of this virulent world movement? Who are the inventors of all this madness? Who transplanted this ensemble into Russia and is today making the attempt to have it prevail in other countries? The answer to these questions disclose the actual secret of our anti-Jewish policy and our uncompromising fight against Jewry. For the Bolshevik International is in reality nothing less than a Jewish international. And that's what we've been saying. Communism is a form of Jewish supremacism that is palatable such that the non-Jewish masses can adopt it and advance the platform.
It's the political expression of the Talmud is what Bolshevism and communism is.
It's basically
the elevation of the international Jewism to the level of Messiah.
And it's Talmudism for non-Jews.
Yes, it is. That's exactly what it is.
It was the Jew who discovered Marxism. It is the Jew who, for decades past, has endeavored to stir up world revolutions through the medium of Marxism. It is the Jew who is today at the head of Marxism in all the countries of the world. Only in the brain of a nomad who is without nation, race, and country could this Satanism have been hatched. And only one possessed of a satanic malevolence could launch this revolutionary attack. It seems maybe Goebbels has read Genesis 3:5 and John 8:44.
Well, Hitler sure did, and he expresses that succinctly in Mein Kampf on several occasions. And he knew exactly what the Bible was all about. And you know, we should probably do a program on the Talmud one day. However, the Talmud gives the Jew license to take the property of the so-called Goyim.
Absolutely.
Well, Bolshevism is the political vehicle to realize that precept in the Talmud.
Well, my dad and I had this discussion a few days ago. I said to him that, interestingly enough, the Talmud clearly states explicitly, in very simple terms, Goyim have no property rights. The Communist Manifesto and Communist doctrine state that the bourgeois have no property rights, and it just so happens that most communists are Jews, most Jews are communists, and they all regard the bourgeois as Goyim and the Goyim as bourgeois.
And it amazes me that so many people can't see this, because it's a very easy correlation.
So communism is a natural end result of Talmudism.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's the Jew's way of effecting the promises of the Talmud that he would have all the property of the non-Jew.
For Bolshevism is nothing less than brutal materialism speculating on the baser instincts of mankind, and in its fight against West European civilization, it makes use of the lowest human passions in the interests of international Jewry. You know, they talk about free love and the liberation of women, but all they do is convince women to debase themselves, and they convince men that it's natural that women should debase themselves and that they should fuel this debasement. We went over that in Russia number one, what the Jew really regards as liberating the woman. They nationalize.
Well, right, and in Wiebe, Germany and the Jewish Problem, he explained it.
So that any
more detail there.
Any Jew is free to defile any white woman he wants, and thus he repeats the Nakash story of the garden.
And that's what the Woman's Lib movie in this, the Woman's Lib movement in this country was really all about. And when you go back and you look at all of the key figures in the Woman's Lib movement, you'll find Gloria Steinem, Jew; Emma Goldman, Jew; Bella Abzug, Jew. They were all Jews.
It was just about making white women accessible for Jews.
That's all it was about, to break down the parental control over a woman and her who she was going to marry or who she should date and who she shouldn't date. That they wanted to pry women, they wanted to pry daughters out of the clutches of their parents. That's what they wanted to do, and they succeeded. And look at our women today.
They wanted to get them out of the dining room, out of the family room, and into the strip club or into the brothel.
Exactly.
The theory underlying this political and economic fanaticism was excogiated by a Jew named Karl Mordecai, alias Marx, the son of a rabbi in
That's excogitated, I'm sorry.
Oh, excogitated, okay. So, son of a rabbi in Treves. A variant of the same theory sprang from the brain of another Jew called Ferdinand LaSalle. He was the son of the Jewish Jaime Wolfson from Laszlo, who changed his first name to Laszlauer, then to LaSalle, then finally to LaSalle. The labor minister of the parish...
He went from Jew to French in four moves.
Have you ever known anybody other than a Jew to change their full name, first, middle, and last?
You know, I could never change my name. My name is my heritage. I could never, ever dream of changing my name.
But Jews really have no heritage, at least none that they want to be open about.
Exactly. And they'll change their names from country to country very flippantly, very easily, and not even care.
They move from Russia to Britain, and all of a sudden, they have a very British name.
Yes, that's exactly the case.
Moshe Kaganov becomes Reginald.
They came into Germany, and they took all German names. They came into England, and they took English names. They came to America, they took American names. That they changed Redstone, you know, Rothstein into Redstone, and a million examples like that.
The labor minister of the Paris Commune was the Jew, Leo Frankel. The Jewish terrorist, Karl Cohen, was the friend of Marx. On 7th May 1866 in Unter den Linden, Berlin, this Cohen made two attempts to murder Bismarck by shooting at him. In pre-war days, the editorial staff of the Verwärts, the German socialist organ, already employed 15 Jews, the majority of whom subsequently became leaders of communism in Germany. Among them were Kurt Eisner, Rudolf Hilferding, and Rosa Luxemburg. During the Great War, the Polish Jews, Leo Jogisch and Rosa Luxemburg, were at the head of the driving forces intent on bringing about Germany's military downfall and the subsequent World Revolution. Another Jew, Hugo Haase, subsequently chairman of the USPD, Independent German Socialist Party, demanded the refusal of war credits on August 4, 1914. What a funny name, Independent German Socialist Party. Independent how? They're probably taking their orders from Lenin and Trotsky.
Well, they're independent in Germany. I don't know. They love these noble-sounding names. Look at the American Civil Liberties Union. There's nothing American or
there's nothing civil about it.
Right. Look at the Southern Poverty Law Center. There's nothing Southern about it, and it has nothing to do with poverty, except the personal poverty of the Jews that founded it to enrich themselves.
And the poverty of their victims, the people they ruined.
Well, right. The people that they ruin end up in poverty. That's what they're about.
And there's really nothing legal about them either.
They love founding noble-sounding institutions with noble-sounding names.
Democratic People's Republic, where the people have no representation, there's nothing democratic, and it's not a republic.
All the time.
On the 10th November 1918, these were formed the Council of Six Representatives of the People. which people? Which included the Jews, Haase and Landsberg. On the 16th December 1918, was held the first meeting of the General Congress of the Workers and Soldiers Soviets of Germany. In this Congress, the Jews Cohen Rus and Hilferding were the principal speakers. The armed forces of Germany were represented by the Jew Hodenberg for the 8th Army and the Jew Levinson for the 4th Army. The Jews Siegfried Mark for the Army Department A, Nathan Moses for Department B, Jacob Reisenfeld represented the Army Group of the Kiev, and Otto Rosenberg represented the Army Group of the Kassel. The first Communist Party Congress was held in Berlin on 31st December 1918, in which the Jewess Rosa Luxemburg was elected leader. The Reich Conference of the Spartacist Movement, held on the 29th December 1918, was formally opened by the official representative of the Soviet Union, a Jew named Karl Radek Sobelson, whilst Rosa Luxemburg appeared as one of the official speakers.
Now, it's amazing that they chose Spartacus as the name for that. Yeah, you know, Spartacus was the slave in southern Italy. He led a slave uprising. I think it was the 2nd century B.C.
I believe it was. And here they are leading an uprising to enslave the masses.
Exactly. They're turning around the meaning of Spartacus. And
only a
legacy.
Satanic Jew could do that.
Absolutely.
On the night between the 6th and 7th April 1919, after the removal of the Jew Eisner in Munich, the Soviet Republic was proclaimed there. The leading part in this was taken by the Jews Laundauer, Toller, Lipp, Erich Mussheim, and Wadler. On the 14th April 1919, a second Soviet government was formed in Munich with the Jews Levin-Nissen, Levin, and Toller at its head. The press of the German Communist Party in Berlin was controlled by the Jews Meyer, Dahlheimer, Scholm, Friedlander, etc. The lawyers who functioned on behalf of the German Communist Party were the Jews Litton, Rosenfeld, Joachim, Opfel, Landsberg, etc. The well-known Bolshevik Jew Raffes writes, quote, "The hatred of Tsarism against the Jews was justified because from the 60s onward, in all the revolutionary parties, the government had to deal with the Jews as the most active members." End
and
quote.
They always tell on themselves. But Christians never read any of this stuff.
We only listen to them when they talk about how their God's chosen.
Absolutely incredible. There's always a Jew in the pack that'll tell on the Jews. And we've had several examples of them in recent times.
All right. At the Second Congress of the Social Democratic Labor Party of Russia in 1903, the split occurred, which divided the party into Bolsheviks and Mensheviks. In the one as well as in the other of these parties, the authoritative positions were held by Jews. These were as follows. In the Mensheviks, Martauer, Zetterbaum, Trotsky, Bronstein, Dan, Gerwitz, Martinow, Lieber, Goldman, Abramowitz, Rhein, Gorev, Goldman. And the second name was always their alias. I'm sorry, the second name was their real name. The first name I read was their alias. In the Bolsheviks, Borodin, better known as Grusenberg, subsequently leader of the Bolshevik revolutionary movement in China, at present Bolshevik commissary in Mongolia.
What's a Grusenberg doing in China? Doesn't he stand out like a sore thumb?
You know, I've pointed out to people that communism in China didn't just spring out of nowhere. It didn't fall from the sky.
No, and it must have been a lot more Jews in China for them to be able to blend in like this.
Communism was imported into China by Jews, basically ambassadors and diplomats from Germany and the Soviet Union. Frumkin, Haneke, Furstenberg, Yaroslavsky, Gubelman.
Well, a.k.a. Gubelman.
Gubelman, leader of the atheist movement in the Soviet Union and throughout the world. Kamenow, better known as Rosenfeld. Lashowitz, Litinow, better known as Wallach. At present, foreign Soviet commissary and formerly chairman of the League of Nations. Lotow, better known as Mandelstam. Radek, better known as Sobelson. Sinowij, 1919 to 1926, leader of the Communist International. Sokolinkov, better known as Brilliant. What a name. Swerdlov.
And that can't be his real name either. he must have been a British Jew. Because that's a name that would only blend in Britain, probably.
Yes. Swerdlov, close friend and co-worker of Lenin. And Lenin wasn't even Lenin. Lenin was Ulanov.
Yes, it was.
In the beginning of August 1917, the 6th Congress of the Bolshevik Party was opened. I'm sorry, I'm just laughing for a second. I'm just wondering if this is part of their bar mitzvah or something. You know, when the boys turn a certain age, the dad says, okay, it's time to pick your name to blend in with the goyim. When the girls turn a certain age, it's time to get their nose job to blend in with the goyim.
Well, I think we should probably leave this here for now because
right.
We're not going to finish it. And next week we should finish this and illustrate again Hitler's feeling on the Jews and international capital and Bolshevism and communism from Mein Kampf.
All right,
to round this out. But because my purpose, I know it's probably your purpose too, but is to illustrate that first, the German people knew about all the crimes of the Bolsheviks and feared communism and Jewish communist rule coming to Germany.
And one of the reasons they knew, because the Bolsheviks were very open about it.
Well, right. And all the Bolsheviks in Germany were Jews. So Hitler was basically knew that he had to remove the Jew from Germany from the same destruction that the German people witnessed Russia undergo.
You couldn't find enough genuine Germans involved in the Bolshevik movement to fill a horse carriage.
No. So Adolf Hitler, basically, the Nazi Party stood up for Christian Germany, and America and Britain destroyed it.
I think we should also get back into proving from Mein Kampf that Hitler was absolutely on board with dual C-line and that he knew there was a titanic clash of good versus evil that had been going on for thousands of years because the Jews are the serpent seed.
There is no doubt. And I'll see you next week. Thank you.
All right. Yahweh bless.
Praise Yahweh.